digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
My next guest on Digging in the Dirt is Mary DeMacher. She's one of the co-founders of the Eugene, Oregon chapter of the International Climate Change Group, 350.org. She became their creative director. She leads public art projects and climate justice events, including one featured in a PBS NewsHour broadcast about children suing the government for their right to a livable planet. She lives in Eugene, Oregon, with her husband, children, and several happy chickens. She has now written a book entitled The Parents' Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, always interested in this subject matter here at Digging in the Dirt, and we want to know why did you feel that you had to write a book like this?
Yeah, well, I felt I had to write it because I needed this book. I would have loved it when I had little kids. My kids are now 18 and 22, so I'm on the other end of it, and I would have loved to have hundreds of ideas like this of ways that I could raise empowered kids and work on, you know, reversing or mitigating the climate crisis and protecting my kids' habitat. So that's what is really difficult for busy parents in such an overwhelming topic like, you know, climate justice and global warming is how do I engage as a busy parent? How do I engage with my family? So I, you know, when I had children, I was worried about global warming, and I worked with my husband on a simple and green lifestyle, but we realized somewhere around 2007 that individual efforts were never going to be enough to stabilize the Earth's climate, and we had to shrink industry's footprint. And that's when I started to work to change the system and not just our light bulbs. So this book is to help people who are like I was, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, with young children and busy and overwhelmed. And I wanted to give people ideas in ways that they could not just manage, but even enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, kids, you know, a lot of hard work. It's tough to get them to do what you want them to do and behave and everything. And then you want us to cure climate change with them also. This is a tall order.
Well, I think the key in this book is to remember that this is not about reinventing the wheel. It's not about doing more. It's about doing things a little differently and about sort of pushing along the solutions that other people are already doing. So this book is full of good news about innovations that are happening, about, you know, wind energy being cheaper than any other form of fossil fuel, about things that are growing and changing, about what's happening in other countries that are banning fracking, which is so devastating for our water and for our air and for, you know, the safety of our communities because there's earthquakes involved in fracking. So I think one of the things that I like to do is tell people there are so many solutions out there, and this book is a guidebook for helping people connect to those solutions. We busy parents do not need to invent brand new solutions or need to start movements ourselves. We just need to kind of put our shoulder to the movements that are already happening everywhere.
Great. So why do you call it a climate revolution?
Well, revolution is when you want to replace one system you don't think is working for you with a system that you hope will. And for our generation, it's the dirty energy system that has to be replaced with a clean and renewable energy system. So climate revolution requires us to say a lot of no. No to what harms the climate and the earth. No to all coal, oil and gas projects and expansions and new pipelines. No to subsidizing polluters. That's a big one because that will save taxpayers literally billions of dollars. And no to fracking. At the same time, all of those no's are saying yes to the things that support life, that support a thriving future for our children, and that support smart climate policy that will allow us to get clean and abundant energy from the wind and the sun, allow more green jobs, give more voice to accurate science, and fund, you know, high-speed bullet trains that should be all over our country and allow us to get from one place to the other easily and with clean, you know, with zero carbon, and then allow us to repair our soils. Healthy soils really pull, and forests pull carbon out of the atmosphere. So a lot of this revolution that's happening is worldwide, and it's been wonderful in my research to find these incredible innovations, like one a couple of months ago that I read about, where a 27-year-old South African woman learned how to gather energy from the whoosh of wind in London's train tunnels. So that's, to me, what a climate revolution is. It's about solar farms in Nevada and Danish bicycling highways and the governors of multiple states in the U.S. now who are upholding the Paris Climate Agreement in their own states. That's the kind of revolution I'm talking about using the innovations we have, using the technologies that we have, and then investing more in finding new solutions and improving them, like the battery life, you know, for lithium batteries is so much better. It's molten salt tanks for wind, for storing solar energy are at this point a complete breakthrough in terms of our ability to use power from the sun during the day to store it and use it at night when the sun goes down. So those are little smattering of some of the solutions that I was able to really read about and research in my 2.5 years of working on this book, is to find that we have the we have the solutions. We just need to know what they are and demand them, and then bring in leaders who are going to actually fund those solutions and steer clear of last century's dead-end fossil fuel technologies.
You're listening to Mary DeMocker. She wrote the book, The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution. You say there are 100 things that you can do, like very specific 100 things that you can do to help the planet. You want to lay out how your book is laid out and give us a few of those examples, because we're not going to get to a whole 100 this afternoon.
Sure, no. Yeah, so the book is divided into 8 sections. Some of them are about saving time and money, which every family likes to do, caring for your soul, which we as parents especially need to do, raising empowered kids, which we need more than ever now with, you know, what we're setting our kids up for in the future in terms of debt and, you know, student debt and national debt and, at this point, carbon debt in the atmosphere. So it's important for kids to learn how to be empowered in many ways, and there are many chapters about that. So you can read the book from start to finish or just crack it open and read a title that you like. Most of them are 2 pages, so they start and end, you know, wherever you open. And there's a big section on building a fossil-free future. That's the last third of the book. So each one has a short story about family life, and I gravitated to the funniest or most moving moments of my 21 years of parenting a boy and a girl. And then each chapter ends with 2 to 10 or 15 ideas that busy parents can use who have varying levels of time and money. And most of them take only a few minutes and cost very little or nothing.
So you talk about simplicity parenting. Tell me what that is.
To me, that's about bringing the level of materialism down for our children to help them live more centered lives. And for example, in our household, that meant not having screens on very much. And our kids were not actually allowed to be on screens at all before they were 7 and 9. It was a little younger when my second child. And I think that really protected them from becoming addicted at a young age to kind of technology and consumerism and being entertained. And we gave them a lot of dirt and a lot of water to play in and a lot of woods to romp in. We gave them day camps. We gave them a lot of equipment to play out in the yard, to move their bodies, to use their imaginations, building sandcastles and stick houses. And for people that are in large cities, that can happen with, you know, a box of chalk on the balcony, anything that connects children to their creativity and to their own sense of empowerment and agency in the world through their play. So that's one of the ways, is through creative play out in the real world and keeping them off screens. Another is to keep the consumerism bar low, and for us, one of the ways we did that was completely avoid the mall. And when my second child hit 6th grade, he really wanted brand name clothing. And we had always shopped at the thrift store or done exchanges with neighbors and used only used clothing for the most part. Some new here and there, but for the most part, back to school shopping was done at thrift stores. And he did not want any part of that. So I said, fine, you have the same budget, $70. Let's go to the mall. Took him to the mall, one pair of $45 jeans, a couple of expensive shirts, and so his back-to-school wardrobe was three things. And he really noticed over the next 3 months, well, now these clothes are used. They're no more special than the other ones, and I don't really have as many clothes as I would have if I had joined you and my sister at the thrift store. So the following year, we gave him the $70 again, and he joined us at the thrift store, came out with two bags overflowing, and then to make it kind of memorable and fun, I stopped and got, you know, fish and chips and whippier floats. So I try to bring down materialism and make it fun, make it something that connects us. So we do a lot of games, we do a lot of music, we do a lot of reading, and I think those are key things now that are kind of being lost in family life because parents are on their phones so much.
Sure. We're all guilty. I totally agree with you. I've got my grandson who's 21 months out in the garden already, and one of his first 50 words is gardening. And what are you doing, Luke? I'm gardening, you know. And, you know, yeah. He loves to water the plants. He goes around with my wife watering all the plants. So it's pretty cool to watch that happen because if you expose it to him early enough, that becomes important to them.
Well, children will do whatever, they'll love whatever their parents love. So if you love monster trucks and ATVs, then they'll love that. And if you love, you know, canoeing and gardening, then they're going to love that. And that's the wonderful thing about young children is that they do what we do. And so this is an opportunity for parents who care about the climate to really bring in those practices and those, and I'm including not just home practices, but practices of democracy and civic engagement and going to hearings and protests when it matters and bringing children with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I like digging in the dirt both figuratively and explicitly in my garden in the backyard, so it works out for me.
Well, so good for you.
Yep. So, you know, I have two children, and they're now in their late 20s and early 30s, and one of them gave me my grandson. And I can be pretty intense on calling out the BS on policies and statements by politicians and deniers, but at times I get them, you know, I see them rolling their eyes and go, oh, Dad, here we go again. You know, so I'm asking you this, telling you this, because I want to ask you about trying to avoid being overly negative and doom and gloom, and how do we keep the subject important to children, no matter what age they are, and not alienate them?
I think the key is solutions. I think what's really rough on anybody is the sense that we're talking about what's wrong without saying enough about what's right, not only what's right, but how we can do something simple to help support it. So, for example, we can rail against all the banks that are supporting Dakota Access Pipeline that was so devastating to indigenous communities and is now devastating down on the other end of the pipeline down in Louisiana in the bayou where there's a big fight. Okay, so we can talk about that fight. But one solution that we can suggest to people and take ourselves is dump your J.P. Morgan Chase card. If you're banking at J.P. Morgan Chase or any bank that is doubling down on investments in fossil fuels, leave that bank. That's one thing we can do. Go to your local credit union. Those are always supporting local people, often students. Ours gives away bikes every year. And that's a simple act we can do. It's just to divest our own banking from the banks that are investing in fossil fuels. And that movement is really making a difference. A lot of the banks are stepping away from funding pipelines, from funding coal trains, from funding new terminals. And that's a key thing that a lot of people don't know. Another thing we can do is suggest that people just make one sign. That's a simple thing people can do. I've just toured all over for my book, and I don't think I saw one sign in one window or one bumper sticker that said, support wind, you know, wind in my backyard. Wind is an incredibly clean, affordable, it comes online fast. It's a wonderful solution to the climate crisis. We can talk about those solutions. We can tell people ways that they can plug in and support those solutions. So I think one key thing is not to kind of overwhelm people with our own despair and our fear and all the news that's bad, because there is bad news. There's a lot of despair. And I think that what we need to do is pivot those conversations around the dinner table to how does government work? how are poor policies put into place? How are good policies put into place? And one of the places that I point people is to Indivisible, which has a wonderful document about how the Tea Party was so good at hijacking public policy over the last few years and then getting, you know, Trump into the presidency. So to really learn about how government works and learn that what we need to do is engage in our democracy and then find out what's going on locally. Find out who's running for office. This is an incredible moment in history right now where we have so many people angry, so many people wanting these policies, these right-wing policies and planet-destroying policies to be gone and to be moving to joining much of the rest of the world in a more cooperative approach to a global emergency. So who are the local candidates around you on the state level and the city level and, you know, in our local communities? Who is really working for progressive policies? Who is actually going to protect the watershed that you drink from? Who's actually going to help deny the permit for the pipeline coming through private, you know, your region? There's a fossil fuel fight everywhere now in this nation, and we need to link up with each other, find those fights, and find our allies. That's what I try to tell people to do, to really specifically find your local fossil fuel fight, whether it's offshore drilling or pipeline or oil trains running through, and make one sign, make one statement. Go to one hearing sometime in the next 3 months where numbers matter, and it really makes a difference when people show up. If there's a permit being considered for, like there is here in Oregon, there's this awful fracked gas export pipeline that we've been fighting for years, and people are showing up in huge numbers at these key moments at the hearings and during comment periods, and they're filling the newspapers with editorials about why it's such a bad idea, not just for the climate, but for Oregonians. So find that fight near you, or find the candidate who's progressive, who needs your support this November, so we can help flip the Congress, which is really one of the last passes we have at this point when we have, you know, potentially the executive branch has gone far to the right at this point, and the court may be slipping far to the right, and we have to reinvigorate democracy. And that's a doable, exciting project that we can engage young people in, and even our adult children in, and help them find out how to do that. So Indivisible is a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that subject, I'm noticing a definitive change in the narrative on renewables and carbon and fossil fuels. More and more conservatives and deniers are calling the environmental movement leftist with like a sort of a communist connotation. Are you seeing and hearing the same thing? And why is that affecting people of all political stripes? I mean, you would think that these environmental issues would supersede color and creed, and but we're getting this conversation framed in a manner that is trying to color people who care about the planet.
Well, I think two things. One is that we have more people now wanting carbon regulated than ever before. So one of the things we need to really focus on is that many Republicans and many Trump Republicans are wanting clean soil, clean air, and clean water. Because, yes, it makes sense. We don't want to poison ourselves, right? That just makes sense. However, at the same time, what's also true is that there are vested interests with Exxon, Shell, Koch Brothers, Bradley Foundation, a lot of right-wing think tanks that are out there actively trying to link clean and renewable energies with something that, you know, something negative. So they've been trying desperately to keep fossil fuels as something that our government will invest in, keep fossil fuels as something that seem inevitable, that we have to have. Well, it's you know, maybe it'll be better to go clean, but for now, you know, to help out people who are low income, we got to stick with fossil fuels. And none of that is true. What's happening is that the fossil fuel industry has captured the White House, captured the Congress, and they've captured a large portion of the media. They've even captured many of the big green groups. Some of those big green groups, like Nature Conservancy and Environmental Defense, are actively working with Shell and BP and Monsanto and Dow Chemical. So even some of the groups that we're looking to for our solutions are not actually pursuing the solutions that climatologists are saying we need, which is to keep fossil fuels in the ground. So I think it's important to remember that there is a campaign to discredit clean and renewable energy and to confuse people about the solutions that we need. And when we remember those things and talk about the fact that there is a campaign of, you know, being waged, and, you know, your guest, Michael Mann, on one of your podcasts spoke to that beautifully about this, you know, this active, very well-funded campaign to create the illusion that there's debate. And this is, you know, Bill McKibben calls it, you know, these are the death throes of an industry that knows that its days are numbered. But it doesn't help to call them the death throes if they're actually still in power. So what we have to do is really educate one another about the solutions, which are to keep fossil fuels in the ground, and then to get into office the people who are actually going to do the things it takes to do that. That means investing in renewable energy, planting a trillion trees, renewing our soil so it can grab carbon out of the atmosphere, investing in molten salt tanks, investing in all the solar and the in-stream hydro and the geothermal and the tidal. There's so many kinds of solutions out there. We already have them. It's just a question now of how we're going to reclaim the democratic structure so that we have those policies in place and we're funding solutions that are going to give our kids a future.
Mm-hmm. I see a lot of polls, though, that say that people put climate change, pollution, environmental issues at a lower priority than, like, say, jobs. It's always the same, seems to be the same narrative. I mean, what's going to change that?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think that we do tend to feed ourselves and our families first and think about the larger issues that are down the road or that are farther away. You know, we can care more about other people when we feel like we're taking care of ourselves. And I think one of the things that will change that is when people understand that it actually is better for our economy, it's better for our health, it's better for our personal finances to have a clean energy future. Fossil fuels cost us a lot of money, and they harm our health. There are 20,000 people a year who die premature deaths in this country alone just from coal and oil burning. And that's actually that's a 2009 study. So it's I'm sure, much higher now. And I think people, once they understand the co-benefits of a fossil-free future, and that's why I wrote this book, is to talk about those co-benefits. It's better for human health to have clean and renewable energy. That's just kind of a no-brainer, but to have it spelled out and to have people read the science and read stories about why it's better. That's what I'm trying to do in my book, is give people something to hold on to, give people a little humor, because the book is actually full of a lot of humorous stories, and it's approaching it in kind of a peppy way to give people an easy way in. It's sort of a soft entry into a conversation about some really big topics, about reclaiming democracy, about what's happening with our kids, you know, the screen addiction at this point, and what's happening to our planet if we don't take charge at this point. And that means reclaiming our authority, not only as parents, but as citizens. And so I think the biggest thing is to give people easy ways in, and that's what I've tried to do in this book, fun, easy ways that help us, you know, reclaim democracy, but also connect with our families.
I'm Kevin Gallagher. We're WPKN. We're speaking with Mary DeMocker, who has a new book out called The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get That Good Night's Sleep. And, you know, Mary, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for being out there fighting the good struggle, and I hope people pick up your book and start doing some of the things that you are suggesting, because it is all up to all of us, and that's why we have this program to bring the stuff to light here, Digging in the Dirt.
I love your program. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing.
Well, you know, I get to the final question of the program, and, you know, the leader of your organization, 350.org, Bill McKibben, where it is regard to degradation of the planet and climate change, he says that winning slowly is losing. And I'm worried about that. I see not enough action. You know, people just, you know, they're going to the beach. They're going to work. They're going there. But it's the planet is still in trouble and getting probably in more trouble day by day. Are we going to be able to help stop this, or at least mitigate it so it's not going to be so painful for people? Or do we need pain and suffering before anything gets done?
Well, let's see. That's a big question. You know, I think it depends on the person. I know for me that I've been working on this issue for over a decade now, because once I had enough information from Bill McKibben, I was, and met him, and I asked, well, should I work on shrinking my family's carbon footprint, or should I work on shrinking the planet's carbon footprint? And he said, get political. We need to shrink the industry's footprint. We need to. Your footprint is minuscule by comparison. So for me, it's a no-brainer, because I'm listening to the science, and I'm watching with my own eyes what's happening. The West Coast was in flames. We could hardly breathe last August. So there's your pain and suffering right there. A lot of people here were depressed, because you could look straight at the sun in the middle of the day without turning away. It was that orange red. It was so smoky. Same thing happening in Houston, Sandy in New York, Katrina, Boston, you know, full in the winter of floods that then froze, you know, under the building. So we had plenty of pain and suffering, and I think what we need now is light and solutions and hope and ideas and easy ways in. I think that talking about the science is important for people that enjoy science. I don't. I like music. I like storytelling. I like going to the beach. All those things you mentioned, you know, I'm doing all those things too with my family. But I'm also at the same time trying to illuminate a pathway for people toward reclaiming the future through storytelling, telling stories about what's happening in other places, telling stories about the solutions that people are following. Like, and it's telling the story, for example, that with the wind potential of three states, Kansas, North Dakota, and Texas, according to Drawdown, the book by Paul Hawken that he edited, those three states alone could power our entire nation. That's exciting news, and that's not the only kind of power we have. We've got lots of other solutions. So for me, I feel like the way to engage people is through joy, through story, the telling about the solutions that are out there, and by giving them something to do where they feel like they're going to be effective, that they're going to be that person that's going to join up with somebody else and make a difference at that hearing about the pipeline. They're going to find a way to read about it with their kids and see that spark in their kids' eyes when they read about, you know, Wangari Maathai down in Africa, down in Kenya, who planted billions of trees with her Green Belt movement down there, and how that impacted and changed the lives of so many women and children in particular, and the whole communities. So I think the solution, you know, the short answer would be to offer solutions, to offer hope through offering explicit ideas and ways for people to engage. And so that's what my book is full of. It's full of hundreds of ideas for people of all kinds of, you know, if you're feeling despairing, there's some things that I offer you to do when you're feeling despairing. If you're feeling like you want to work on the local level, I've got ideas for that. If you want to help divest the banks, then there are ideas or letters in the back of the book. There's an appendix with some sample letters for how to help the divestment movement. There is a huge movement going. It's hard to see sometimes with the mainstream media. So my book is full of little peepholes into the movement that's happening, and once you start seeing it, you'll see it everywhere, and then it's easy to join. The key is to be together with other people, even just one other person, because what's so damaging about the environmental crisis is that we often get our news alone, and we often feel that we're alone in this crisis, so we have to solve it. All we need to do is join with others and take one little piece. So find, in my book, you can find it on marydemocker.com, you can find it on Amazon, and see if it appeals to you. See if you can find one little thing in there that you can do yourself or with your family that helps you feel like you are engaged in solutions rather than part of, you know, what Kathleen D. Moore has said is that industry is making us foot soldiers in our own destruction. And I think that's a really devastating experience that a lot of us have on the soul level, is that day to day, like, oh, I just went shopping and there's all this plastic and I'm just part of the problem. Or, oh, I just went to my father-in-law's funeral back east. And that was hard to do in terms of feeling like I was flying. So these are the things that we need to engage in, the solutions that help us connect with other people and help build the political movement that will change the policies so that I'm not taking an airplane to go back to New Jersey. I'm taking a bullet train. That's what we should have. That's what other countries have. And that's what my book kind of points to, where there are other solutions that other countries are already having in place. And we just don't know about them as much in this country. And once people do, they get excited. And excitement and emotional engagement, that's really what helps people join in a campaign with what we need to do, which is seize this clean, renewable energy future for our kids.
And thank you for writing a book for parents to help their kids and teach their kids, because the kids are going to inherit this earth, and we need them on board sooner than later. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, I also want to say it's for teachers and for grandparents and aunts and uncles and doctors and counselors, and it's for any adult that works with families or young people. And I hope people will go get it and enjoy the book. And thanks for letting me be here.
Sure. And we're just finished speaking with Mary DeMocker, who wrote the book, The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.
I'd like to remind you that you can hear all the podcasts online at SoundCloud and iTunes. Always appreciate you pushing around to other people the program, and always appreciate your support for WPKN and hence Digging in the Dirt. I'm Kevin Gallagher.
It's like this. Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes and true currents. Thriving seas, wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Good planets are hard to find.